you like this episode, please subscribe, share with others, rate and review so we can continue to bring you great programming.
Welcome to Inclusion Catalyst. We invite diversity leaders to the table to deconstruct complex social justice issues and showcase the best inclusion practices in our workplaces and our communities.
Hello, my name is James Connor. I'm here with Lauren Tucker and Gary Johnson on the Inclusion Catalyst podcast. And we're looking forward to having a very good conversation around diversity, equity, and inclusivity. Thank you both, Lauren and Gary, for being guests on today's show. I'm looking forward to our conversation and learning quite a lot from both of you. If you don't mind, can you give us a quick intro of who you are and where you are in your experiences in the DEI space?
Yeah, I can start. I'm, as you said, Dr. Lauren Tucker. I pivoted this company called Do What Matters after the George Floyd murder. Originally, it was intended to be a digitally driven multicultural communications company, but we pivoted after the George Floyd murder because we were really frustrated after seeing all of the, corporate responses, which we've of course seen, it seems like every 2 years, something happens and, the U.S. business community gets some pang of concern and guilt or combination of both. And, I was just frustrated with the lack of progress on diversity, equity, and inclusion. We decided to promote a different approach to increasing diversity by starting with inclusion first. I realized that it also was important for me to get outside of the corporate world. I had been a chief strategy officer at Merge. And so I realized, as much as I rang the bell there, as well as other places where I've worked, when it comes to diversity, it's just hard to be a prophet in your own land. So I decided to turn 30 years of my business experience and focus on inclusion first management, because we just believe that traditional diversity efforts have often actually hurt the very people that they were intended to help, and good intentions have not led to sustainable impact. And so we realized that we needed to connect the dots between intentions, actions, and impact by really starting with inclusion first and making, helping companies make their cultures positive places where everyone can feel safe, valued, and heard. And then when you start to invite difference in, you're inviting differences, relevant differences, into your organization where you've already established inclusivity. And we believe that inclusion strategy will ultimately result in greater diversity and representation. So that's really the background to where we are today at Do What Matters.
Excellent. Thank you for sharing, Lauren. From all the stuff that I've seen, you've been doing some great work at Do What Matters. So, and we greatly appreciate it. Gary, can you give us a little feedback on, who you are and all the things you're doing? I know you got a lot going on, but provide us some insight into what it is to grow it in your career.
So, absolutely. Thank you, Jim. I'm Gary Johnson III. I am a founder, investor, and ecosystem builder, just really passionate about building a more equitable and inclusive startup ecosystem where we all can thrive. I graduated from University of Delaware back in 2018. And since then, after sort of falling in love with entrepreneurship and the process of identifying and tackling some really big and important problems, realized that, I want to build this infrastructure to provide opportunities for other people to be able to do that same thing. So in 2019, we launched an organization called First Founders, Inc., which is a 501c3 nonprofit on a mission to empower underrepresented early stage founders and make sure that whatever entrepreneurial ecosystem they come from, they still have access to the resources, whether it's funding, mentorship, or education that's needed to build a scalable and successful startup. So we've been doing that since 2019, started with a cohort of just 8 entrepreneurs based in Newcastle County, Delaware. We had our county actually sponsor our first cohort there. It was a curriculum that I had designed and built up after learning best practices of other programs and studying other entrepreneurial ecosystems across the country. And since that first cohort, we've operated about 3 different programs, as well as a few different pitch competitions, and built our community to now including over 250 founders from around the world who are all in the early stages. And many of them are told they're too early, you know, for this program or for that investor. But we create this environment and this community where everyone is welcome. And we try to become this sort of launch pad that helps create access to more advanced programming. So now we partner with some other great accelerators and programs and investors to create this pipeline for early stage founders who may not be, you know, strongly represented in their local ecosystems, still have access to this global community of resources and support.
Thank you very much. And I also wanted to point out that I also have been part of Gary's cohort in the First Founders Accelerator Program. And I met some very, very bright entrepreneurs, people like Melanie Obman, that they're so much, you know, your platform has been helping out a lot of underrepresented founders. So thank you for your work as well, Gary.
Appreciate you. I'm just glad that you joined us in the community, and appreciate all the value that you added to it as well.
Oh yeah, no man, it was a pleasure, and dude, you have some great insight. I mean, just talking and sharing with people. So we appreciate you. All right, I want to go ahead and start off. We're going to be talking about diversity, equity, inclusion. So, Lauren, when someone talks about diversity, equity, inclusion to you, you know, outside of the regular definition that we all see on LinkedIn posts, what does that mean to you?
Well, for me, again, we start with inclusion first. So we talk about IEND rather than DEI. For us, you know, we use the metaphor of the canaries in the coal mine, right? And, you know, my team, we actually uncovered this picture of what is called a canary resuscitator that was in use back in the late 19th and early 20th centuries when coal miners, you know, would go into the coal mines. They would take canaries who would be early, you know, that early warning system of methane gases in the mines, which would often kill the canaries, and it wasn't too great for the miners either. And so some wily coyote genius came up with this idea of a canary resuscitator, which I'm assuming, you know, people said, oh my, you know, we're spending too much money on canaries, or these canaries aren't strong enough, or something. Who knows what was going on? But somebody said, well, maybe we should just resuscitate the canaries. So we just started like thinking, wow, are they bringing these canaries to the brink of death and then resuscitating them? Mm-hmm. And we thought that was actually a really good metaphor for, you know, really the I'm going to say it, the failure of diversity first management solutions, which I think have done a lot on consciousness raising, but it really has not had the sustainable impact that that I think employees and customers of companies and brands expect. And so we started to reframe the mission from diversity first management or DEI to inclusion first, because we realized it's not about fixing the canaries. It's about fixing the mines and, you know, making sure that the miners right now are, you know, feeling safe, valued, and heard. Because then, you know, if you're going to start bringing in the canaries, you know, the canaries are going to be the first to die, right? So we started to use that as our metaphor for saying we first have to make sure that our clients are building cultures where everybody feels safe, valued, and heard. And then inclusion management is about getting people, getting that talent into the, you know, getting the right talent into the right jobs and elevating their relevant differences so they can contribute that complexity of human experience into creating products and services and cultural content, that is going to be meaningful and memorable and remarkable to an increasingly multicultural, transcultural, and global world. So we are really on, I believe, on the vanguard of a number. There are a few of inclusion-first companies out there. We are still, I don't think, you know, the balance of the industry, but we are certainly making inroads because we are I think people are realizing that inclusion first strategies are really the key to sustainable growth in terms of diversity and greater representation, and making that connection between diversity and prosperity for corporate cultures.
Excellent. That's an interesting story to use metaphor. So it's definitely something that I wasn't aware of before. So thank you for sharing, Lauren. Gary, same question to you, man. What does DEI mean to you?
I would echo everything that Lauren just said. And I would say, in addition to that, you know, for us in the startup space, so many of our communities that we live in may already be diverse, but they're most definitely not inclusive to the point where, you know, when you go to your local co-working space, or you go to a pitch competition, or you go to a networking fair for startups, there's not much representation in those spaces. And that's due to the fact that more diverse communities are not invited to come in and participate. So, you know, we know we exist, but we may not know that these rooms in particular exist. So for me, inclusion definitely comes first. And that's because when it comes to startups and technology enabled ventures and venture capital, we see this as one of the greatest vehicles for wealth creation, right? And we see companies that are able to start out as just an idea and then go on to become Uber or become Lyft or become Airbnb. And, you know, these were just ideas in someone's head. It may have started out as just a rough sketch of that idea on a napkin that was presented to someone who decided to invest in that idea and see what it could become. And our experience has been that we don't have the same access to individuals who are willing to take those bets that are definitely highly risky, but are able to potentially provide high returns for the greater community. So for me, the equity piece is also important because we want to make sure that the companies that are coming out of our community, the individuals that are in our communities, have the same opportunities to build a company that could go on to create returns for themselves, personally, their families. And, you know, when that company is able to be successful, then those returns sort of circulate throughout their local ecosystem and the greater community. And then on the investor side, there's such a lack of diversity in the investor space. So when it comes to, you know, wealthy individuals who are taking bets on startup ideas that could go on to become multi-billion dollar companies, there aren't many people that look like any of us in those spaces. There are so very few people who are even, you know, able to acquire certain levels of wealth. So for us, we see our job as one that's sort of combating these issues and creating pathways to not including more startup founders and entrepreneurs in this space, but also including more individuals who may follow this path of becoming investors, who will go on to create those equity investments that will go on to create more returns for our community. So for me, it's of course all three things combined, but especially making sure more of us are included in these spaces, and more of us understand what it means to truly, truly have equity in something that will provide exponential returns over the long
term. Agreed. Yeah, you can't have diversity and equity if we're not there. You know, so if we're not present in the room, if we're not, we don't know about where these opportunities are, you know, we don't have a chance to be there. So it's a matter of being able to network with each other. So I thank you for that. You both have hit it spot on. I really love the way you see the importance of inclusion for being first for when we talk about diversity, equity, and okay, Lauren, for my next question is, what has influenced you and your thinking around DEI, and what motivated you to get involved in being an advocate for change?
Well, I've been a community organizer and an activist for quite some time, since my days at the University of Wisconsin as a graduate student. So I tend to run into trouble rather than run away from it. That's the way I like to look at it. So if I see a burning building, I tend to run towards it. If I see that something needs to be done. And so when I got back to Chicago in 2016, the beginning of 2017, I worked with a few other founders to start Indivisible Chicago, which is a progressive civic organization that is designed to help people really participate in our democracy and to make that easy and accessible through technology, through a distributed organization of neighborhood groups. And so I took 2 years of just basically pro bono time to as the marketing director to help build that organization from 30 original people coming together to now we have about between 60 and 70,000 members in Chicago. We have done a tremendous amount of work, not just here in Chicago and Illinois, but we have worked with our counterparts in Wisconsin and in Michigan to help move the dial on progressive issues, including helping progressive politicians get elected. And so, very deep into that movement, was the person who basically designed the Families Belong Together march here in Chicago. We had almost 70,000 people show up to that march in the middle of summer. It was 99 degrees. But it showed the commitment of everybody to really support what we consider to be the values that this country actually does stand for, should stand for, and should be focused on. And so my background has been really about that kind of activism that, as a Black woman, growing up Black in America, right, and female in America, and believing in the ideals of this country, even though we have not lived up to them, I've always believed in the ideals of this country and have done, have used my activism and my community organizing to, and use this company to really help this country not just live up to its ideals, but live up to its potential. We live in a highly politicized and polarized democracy right now, and that just is not it. This is not going to work. And so, really focusing on inclusion, helping companies lead the way, and hopefully helping corporate America, which if you had asked me a few years ago, I would have said, if you had said to me, corporate America might actually save democracy, I would have laughed at you. But I actually feel that corporations are starting to really wake up to the need to sustain these practices of inclusion, equity, and diversity because it's good for business, but it's good for our country. When we've won, as a country, it's been because we've all come together. Maybe not under necessarily the best circumstances, and it hasn't always lasted the way we wanted. But we really need to get back to that. And so, for me, this is a very highly personal mission of citizenship that I do what I can to encourage the people in this country to come together, regardless of their perspectives, different perspectives, and their different backgrounds, because we have to use you know, we're all in the same boat. We're all in the same boat, and we keep acting as if we're not.
Yeah.
And those of us who might be in the back of the boat, we may have bigger leaks, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the people in the front of the boat may have smaller leaks.
Mm-hmm.
But we are all going to sink together, or we're going to float together. And I don't see enough of political leadership saying this and reminding us of that. And so I am dedicated to hopefully creating corporate leaders and corporate, you know, corporations to stand up and show this kind of leadership that is needed if this country is going to compete globally in this global market, which is here to stay, right? That's not going away. So fighting it, I don't know why people try to do that. What we need to do is make sure that we are leveraging the full potential of our citizens in this country. And that means we have to be inclusive, and we have to provide opportunities for everybody to live up to their fullest potential. That's what's required if we're going to compete on a global stage.
Okay. That's powerful. And I commend you for all your work, especially, you know, growing at the organization. Gary, so the same question to you. What has influenced you and motivated you to get involved and being an advocate for change in the DEI space?
Yeah, I think, you know, similar to Lauren, it's personal. That's really all it is. Especially growing up, you know, we're taught that this is, America is a melting pot, you know, and we're built on these ideals of equality for all and justice for all. And it sort of feels like you grow up and you get into the real world and you start to see that's not exactly what is practiced, you know, on a wide scale. So, for me being in the startup space, you know, in college during undergrad, I was exposed to like so many entrepreneurial opportunities and programs and resources that our university had to offer. And I took advantage of all of them. You know, like I was trying to learn as much as possible and dive in. And being somebody who was also already an activist and advocate, you know, being president of the NAACP on campus, you know, community organizing and things like that were super important already. So applying that mindset to the startup world is sort of something I've been operating with since then. And having been a founder, particularly being a Black founder, you know, you see the trials and tribulations firsthand. And more times than not, I was one of one Black person in many of these rooms and opportunities. But I always felt like it was my responsibility to make sure that other people had the same opportunity. So even though I was at a university, I made sure that anything I was learning, I shared that with the general community. So, you know, I was already doing sort of nonprofit work in our local ecosystem and decided, you know what, like I've learned a lot. I've developed my own personal leadership skills and public speaking skills through doing pitch competitions, and just throwing my ideas out there and trying to become better. So let's do something like that, you know, for the young men in the community who get a bad rep, you know, like at the time, Wilmington, Delaware, where I was working, Wilmington, Delaware was the murder capital, essentially, of the United States. And I know a lot of cities say that. So for Delaware, it was specifically, it was the highest murder rate per capita. So Wilmington is a relatively small city with a high murder rate. So there was a Netflix documentary that was in development called Murdertown USA. And it was based on and being filmed in Wilmington, Delaware. And the community response to that was, you know, no, we don't want this. We don't like this. We don't want to be represented in this way. And for me, you know, I'm always thinking, okay, well, what can I do? And I saw entrepreneurship as one of those solutions. So ended up launching a pitch competition called the I Have a Dream Pitch Competition. We held it the week of MLK Day. And really wanted to flip that narrative on its head and paint a picture of possibility and innovation potential, you know, that the young men in our community have, and to show them and tell them, hey, we know what you can become, and we want to show you that and create a platform for you to, you know, maximize it. So we essentially replicated the Shark Tank model. You know, had a whole pitch competition where all the judges were black men from Wilmington, Delaware, who had gone on to become successful entrepreneurs or investors, to show these young men, this could be you too, you know, like, and it's okay to blaze your own path and do things on your own terms. But we want to make sure you see yourself represented in these different career paths and, you know, just understand that you can aspire to be so much more than what you may see yourself defined as, you know, in the local news. So that's sort of like how I got into the space, and just since then have seen so many just problems firsthand of lack of diversity, lack of inclusion, certainly a lack of equity in these spaces. And I've sort of just developed this passion for making sure that other people have the access and have the resources, because we have all the statistics, all the data that tells us, you know, like, for example, when I got started, like, black women were the fastest growing group of entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. And the data shows that when this group is able to be successful, it's more likely that the returns from those successful businesses come back into the community and create thriving communities. So when we invest in black women, we're investing in strong communities. Makes sense to me. But then when we look at, you know, the funding gap, it's not even a gap. It's like non-existent. You know, less, it's a fraction of a percentage that black women are receiving in venture capital, you know, the funding necessary to build a successful, you know, scalable venture. So it just became personal for me. You know, I was inspired to become an entrepreneur because of my mother, who's a black woman who, you know, in my understanding, you know, looking back, like, she never called herself an entrepreneur. She never called herself a founder or even a small business owner. She was just doing what she had to do to provide for her family. So I definitely saw it firsthand, you know, what it means to use entrepreneurship as a means of, in all honesty, survival. You know, it's not, this isn't a luxury thing. This isn't what's cool on Twitter and what's cool on social media. This is entrepreneurship because we have to do for self. So, you know, it's important for me to make sure that more black women or women or black and brown individuals have access to the resources necessary. And then just like being an advocate, being an activist, it's been honestly kind of crazy at times where, you know, I'm sort of presenting to individuals who do not identify as a person of color, who sees the work of creating more access and equity in this space as reverse discrimination. So becoming someone who in some, you know, pitch rooms has been called out as, you know, hey, isn't this reverse discrimination? Aren't you just doing the same thing that essentially racists are doing? Is what would be thrown my way. So, you know, it's absolutely not that. Like I said, we have the data, we have the information. We are trying to build an equitable and inclusive world where everybody can succeed. And to do that, it means doubling down on the underfunded, underrepresented, and under-resourced demographics that we have in our community. So that's what's motivated me. And I think, you know, what keeps me going and what gets me up is just working with so many amazing, dope founders who, through all the problems, just continue to push forward. And I think, like, that's the spirit of America. That's the human spirit, is just picking yourself up, doing what you can, and trying to make something happen, trying to make that dream come true. So for me, I'm motivated by being able to work with amazing people and try to help them as well.
Right. And Jim, yeah. let me just jump in, because I think Gary made a really good point here. Well, you've made several good points, and I'm going to kind of try to tie some of them in a bit of a bow. And that is, you know, as we all know and have seen and I use this word very purposefully, the incredible rise of Elizabeth Holmes and the just unbelievable, egregious situation that was created there in her fall. You know, Elizabeth Holmes is the founder and CEO of Theranos. And, you know, you know, like Gary, you know, sometimes I've gotten these kinds of, well, is this reverse discrimination? And, you know, focus on, you know, black founders or entrepreneurs. You know, don't get me wrong. I think a lot of white women are not getting the kind of support and championship from VCs that they should. But this really, you know, with somebody like Elizabeth Holmes, it was unbelievable. I mean, she got $500 million from, you know, the white male establishment primarily, for something that wasn't, there was no proof of concept. She never even was able to prove that the thing worked. Whereas many of the black female entrepreneurs that I know, you know, they have proof of concept. They have been able to, you know, bootstrap their own businesses, and, you know, people are closed, you know, the doors have remained closed to them. So I think we have to really, when we get these arguments of reverse discrimination, I think we also have to, and I'm going to say something pretty provocative here, Jim, but the bottom line is we're just trying to create an equitable situation for folks that have had 400 years of affirmative action. You know, there's a lot of conversation. The Supreme Court's now considering, you know, the Harvard case, et cetera. And people always love to talk about reverse discrimination and, oh, affirmative action doesn't work and so forth. And what I would argue is, what do you mean it doesn't work? 400 years of affirmative action is what has resulted in somebody like Elizabeth Holmes, who has received $500 million for an idea that was never proven to work. And I think we have to start calling these situations out. We have to essentially arm ourselves with what we like to call in our work in you know, inclusion nudges, right? And that's called flipping the script. So when people start to accuse, you know, us of reverse discrimination, I think we have to remind people, and Gary, I know you know this, and Jim, I know you know this too, that the median, you know, net worth of the average African-American household is $17,000, and the median net worth of an average white household is $117,000. That is what generational wealth will do. Now, don't get me wrong, as a person, my father's an economist, and both of those numbers are sorely low, but what we're trying to do, I think, is really wake people up to the fact that there has been historical advantages that have been compounded every generation, and we need to now put our focus to those underrepresented groups that have not benefited from 400 years of affirmative action. So I think we have to call out these things, and we have to flip the script on those people who so easily like to throw around phrases like reverse discrimination. We oftentimes don't call it out, I think, because we're afraid of being controversial or afraid of being provocative. But I have no such fear.
Hey, good for you. Yeah, no, I have. There's definitely been times where both of you make excellent points where we have to fight against, you know, just trying to find a place for our, you know, for us. You know, we're not saying, hey, you know, you can't be part, you know, in a certain community. I mean, First Founders Accelerate Program is for black and brown founders. But if there was an occasion where someone asked Gary to join and they weren't of black and brown ethnicity, you know, it could be a discussion and be welcomed in. So it's just a matter of just identifying those areas where we say, hey, look, we're trying to make up for lost time, basically.
Yeah. And if I could speak to that really quickly, you know, we've never turned someone away because of how they identify. You know, we say, you know, in our marketing, who we're looking to support.
Yep.
And that attracts a certain demographic, the one that we're looking for. But when we have white men who want to join in our community, you know, we make sure that everybody is aligned in our principles, right? And sort of subscribe to the values that we set out. And so long as you're committed to that, you're included. You're welcome to join. It's like we're building an inclusive community. We don't want to turn someone away because of how they identify. But we want to make sure that if you're coming in here, you value diversity, you value equity, and you make sure that, you know, you embody that and represent those ideals, not only in our community, but in your own community.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. All right. The next topic I want to talk about is that sometimes, and I've had this experience before, I've gone out on interviews, and unfortunately I've run into this in my hometown of Philadelphia, which, you know, you're meeting with someone, you're getting to know a prospective employer, and you may ask, you know, may notice the lack of diversity, maybe call them out on it or ask them, you know, hey, you know, how important is diversity to your organization? You know, and they'll respond, well, you know, we hire, promote the best person in the job. We're not looking at race. We don't see gender or race, but we just want the best fit. Based off of that statement, how do you respond? How should someone, an organization, what would you say, hey, well, you're missing out on these things when you identify diversity as something as an important aspect of hiring? So Gary, how would you respond to, you know, someone that answers that question that way, and what they're missing out on for all the advantage?
Yeah, for sure. I think I'm really interested in hearing Lauren's answer. But for me, you know, everybody says that, right? Everybody says, oh, we're simply looking for the best talent. And I would just throw it back at them and say, well, how do you know that you have created an opportunity where you're tapping into a diverse talent pool, right? Like, I would question, you know, have you seen a diverse array of candidates? You know, like, does your talent pool draw from HBCUs? Does it represent your local community's demographics? And I would venture to assume that it does not. So I would question those things. And I think it's a cop out, honestly, in a lot of scenarios, because it's the easy thing to say. You know, everybody wants the best talent. Yes, of course. But how do you know that you have truly cast a wide net to make sure that you have tapped into a diverse array of communities and skill sets? And from my research, from the discussions I've had, most people see the same talent over and over again because they're tapping into pools, whether it's Ivy League schools or, you know, whatever. If they're using some form of a recruiting platform or something like that, they see a pretty homogeneous set of candidates coming to them. So I would really just throw it back their way and say, well, can you prove to me that you actually are tapping into a diverse talent pool?
Right. Agreed. Lauren, same question to you. Why should we care? Why should an organization care about DEI? How does it affect their culture at their organization, as you've seen with the companies that you work with?
Well, first of all, I love Gary's answer, and Gary, you and I have to get together. I'm kind of, and Jim, I'm going to do everything I can not to use up all of your time talking about how passionate I am about this issue.
Oh, no, you're fine.
Mainly because, I will say this, mainly because I will just say that answer, you know, that response to this idea of, oh, we're looking for the best talent, it's such BS. I will say, having really been deep into the way in which companies recruit, interview, and hire talent, most of them continue to use the most operationally inefficient ways of that process. And I would say that when I get inside and I find out exactly how people are recruiting talent, the fact that they can look themselves in the face and you know, look themselves in the mirror and say they're hiring the best talent, it just, they're lying to themselves and they're lying to everybody else. And we can see that in today's big quit, right? You know, for us, a major part of what we do and do what matters, it's just really focused on the operational inefficiencies in organizations that foster bias and inclusion. And one of the major operational inefficiencies is the way that most companies go about recruiting and interviewing and hiring talent. Mm-hmm. And so, first of all, how many of you have seen the, you know, job descriptions that are basically the job, you know, the dog's breakfast of expectations? And we know that when, you know, you put in 20, you know, quote unquote requirements and nice to haves, women and people of color, typically, if they can't match all 20 of those, they won't apply for the role. When you have a white man who meets one of them, they'll apply for the role. So already, you know, the people that, you know, are some of the best talent have already taken themselves out because the job description itself is just a scandal. So, you know, and then the interviewing process, we do not typically in corporate America, we're not training people. We're not training hiring teams on how to actually talk to people about competency-based, with a competency-based directive. So I would say that this has been a nice little myth that people have used to not do the work. You know, we started out working with advertising companies and, you know, most of my team has come from marketing and advertising and communications. And I talk to chief creative officers right now who still rely on, you know, the portfolio process to evaluate creative work. Now, you know, in advertising agencies, it's really the creative departments that are still largely white and largely male, although there's been some advances in that area. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. We know that only 14% of all advertising is actually remembered or correctly attributed. So if there was such great talent there, right, then why isn't the product of these mostly white and male creative departments better?
Right.
Why are they not more effective? And so I think it's really critical for us to call the question here because there's been a whole cottage industry around creating portfolios. The Brand Center, you know, which I have a lot of respect for in Richmond, Virginia, one of the most elite, where advertising and branding educations that you can get. Well, I think that's like $32,000 a year. Already you're excluding, right? Because, you know, having that kind of money is impossible for a lot of underrepresented groups. And yet those underrepresented groups are using things like TikTok, Instagram, Twitch, Facebook to express their creativity and their marketing creativity. And they're being quite successful at it. And that should be a good enough portfolio, right? So we're really talking to people about really reframing that thinking because they are not getting the best people. They're just getting those people who are willing to apply for those jobs. And then the entire interview and evaluation process is set up to end up getting the best of the people that may apply and not even that. So I would say that, you know, we really need to rethink and retool and rewire the way that we recruit, interview, and hire. And we need to start with making sure that we understand what are the jobs to be done? What's the performance requirements? And stop putting in all kinds of other unnecessary nice-to-haves that really aren't germane to this person's job success.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree with everything you said. It's and I usually postulate with this because I had a couple of times where, you know, it's come up as a conversation. You know, if I as a black man in the technology space and I walk into a company that I'm thinking about applying to for a position and I see everybody as white, you know, it may not put that organization at the top of my list, or, you know, it might be saying, hey, am I going to be comfortable coming in here talking with, you know, working with these people every day? And then I always flip it on to the other side. I've asked people, hey, if you came into this company and everybody was black and as a white man, would you feel comfortable working here? they'll probably say, no, probably not as comfortable as if it was mixed. But you can't wait until your 40 hires in and you hire nothing but white men and a couple of white women, and then expect to say, okay, now we want to bring in brown and black people. No, it doesn't work that way. You have to be decisive in your commitment to that, to your culture at the very beginning. I'm going to ask one last question of both of you, but I want to thank you again for both being on the show. The question I have is, what advice do you have for those who want to be DEI advocates? And for those companies that want to get started with DEI, what's the advice that you would provide to them? Lauren, you can go ahead.
Well, I think you really first have to, you know, we talk about it this way. You use this as a GPS, and you don't use a GPS to find out how you got lost. And there's a lot of this kind of getting stuck in quote unquote the problem, right? And so everybody's living in the problem. And so we really encourage you to be solutions focused. Use GPS to figure out where you want to go. And then you can debate the pathways to get there, but you don't use a GPS to find out how you got lost. Mm-hmm. And so you really need to focus on where do we want to end up? What does the desired future look like? Too often we engage in DEI, or what I like to say, you know, IED, as a problem to be solved rather than an opportunity to be embraced and elevated. And so I would encourage anybody who's thinking about these issues from a consultant's standpoint or from a company standpoint, you really have to integrate inclusion strategy into your operational strategy. And that means you have to have a very clear vision of what do you want the desired future to look like. Don't use this as a way of avoiding the dreaded future. We spend a lot of time, 80% of our time is spent on the dreaded future. How do we avoid it? Now, that's not what we're about. We're about helping people get to their desired future. And you know what? There's a lot more consensus when we start investigating and doing our discovery process. There's a lot more consensus around where everybody wants to go. Then the key is identifying strategies to get you there. And inclusion strategy is about how can we use inclusion to get you to your desired future? And that starts out from a positive space. It lowers resistance to the entire project, and it gets everybody rowing in the same direction to get to that desired future. And that's our biggest recommendation.
Nicely done. Very good answer. Yeah, it's just I love the GPS metaphor. That's such a good metaphor. Gary, do you have anything to add on that? Because I know you got lots of advice for those that are looking to help with the inclusivity.
Oh, for sure. I would say listen to Lauren first and foremost. And then, I think it's about measuring what matters, you know, setting those metrics to say, okay, we understand how lost we are. And we've set that North Star to say where we want to go, and make sure that you are setting measurable goals, right? To track that progress over time and be open with those goals, so that the organization can hold itself accountable, and for people who are looking advocates for change in this space as well, I think it's about essentially creating that accountability, even if companies don't want to hold themselves accountable, because I think we unfortunately have to do the work ourselves sometimes and show and sort of expose how inequitable companies can be. And sort of force their hand to make sure that we hold them accountable and actually becoming better over time.
Hey, great share. Thank you both for a great show. It's been a pleasure having you on Inclusion Catalyst Podcast. I think what we talked about today was very insightful. You guys gave great advice for those that may not know exactly, everything about DEI and what diversity, equity, and we didn't go into too much about equity, but at the same time, we definitely did a deep dive in inclusivity and how important it is to make sure we all feel included in order to continue having these conversations. Do either of you Lauren, you can go first. Either of you have anything that you want to mention or last thoughts?
Just, you know, inclusion matters. And it is the key to not just building a strong company culture, but we've really got to take it to the next level and start building stronger community cultures and civic cultures in this country based on making sure that everybody feels like they are a part of that desired future. And it's, you know, I'm naive enough to believe that somehow my voice will carry that far to that distance, but that's my desired future.
Excellent. Gary?
Just that demographics are changing. There's a shift happening, and DE&I, this is the only way forward, because we are becoming an increasingly diverse country, an increasingly diverse world. And, you know, we're all in for a rude awakening if we don't better understand that we need to work together, collaborate, and make sure that, you know, we're all supporting one another. So I think everybody needs to embody all of these principles.
Definitely. I totally agree 100%, especially in this kind of political climate. It just seems sometimes that, you know, we're going our own ways. We're segregating ourselves. And it's not because we're forced to. It's because some of us choose. That it doesn't need to be that way. So I think as we unite and bring each other together, and as you said, collaborate, we'll be better for it. And Lauren, again, thank you for all your time. You've been very, very knowledgeable, and I can feel your passion. And it just soaks into everything that you're saying. So thank you for your time today. Gary, it's been wonderful. Keep going, man. You've been doing great things, and we look forward to seeing more from all the First Founders Group and from Bisonman.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Jim.
You can bring your stories to the table as a partner and a host on the Inclusion Catalyst podcast. Visit inclusioncatalyst.com and click the link that says join us as a guest host.
And that's it for this episode of Inclusion Catalyst. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues.